The Committee on Environmental and Natural Resource will come to order Thursday, January 27th. Welcome, members. Welcome, audience, to the meeting today. On the agenda, starting out, we're going to be introduced to and talked to by the new commissioner, Paul Austin from the PCA. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Also, in your packets, members, you have a executive order by Governor Dayton, Executive Order 1104. Commissioner Austin has said that he would discuss that with you, and if you have any questions, he's just going to be here for a short time for a short introduction, then we'll go into some presentations from the permitting and environmental review stuff. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Austin. I'm the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, and I'm sure this is the first of a number of conversations we'll have as the policy and budget spool up on environment this year. Some of you were in the conversation we had last week. That was just yesterday on in the Jobs and Commerce Committee. I'll just take a moment and kind of walk through how the administration is thinking about environmental permitting and review reform at this point, how the executive order kind of fits into the process as we're thinking about it, and take whatever questions you might have after that. Right now, when we're thinking about the issues around environmental permitting and reform, the marching orders I have from the governor are pretty straightforward. He wants the agency to operate in a way that is fair, impartial, timely, predictable, creating an atmosphere that allows economic growth while not compromising environmental protections. This executive order is a piece of that puzzle. When we were looking at Senate File 1 and its co-part in the House, we realized that we have great agreement with the two bills on a number of the sections, and that a number of the sections could be implemented through executive orders. It's essentially a management-level activity as opposed to something that would absolutely require statutory activity. And so the items that are laid up in the executive order itself are those items that could be done that way. And that includes the movement to electronic information sharing. It includes the 150 and 30-day goals for findings around permits and environmental reviews. It includes a requirement for the agency I'm with to come back to the governor within 60 days to make some recommendations on rule changes that would allow conformance with some pre-construction on some permitted types of activities. And it also directs us in our statement of need and reasonableness, which is essentially the preamble and analysis and logic for rules changes on water, air, and land standards, to describe some of the logic if we're becoming in more stringent than the federal standards, and describe some comparisons to the regional states so we can see how we compare to our neighbors and potential economic competitors. When I'm thinking about this, that's step one. Step two is there's a couple of pieces of Senate File 1 that absolutely need to have legislative activity, and I'm thinking specifically about the ability for the proposer to hire an entity to develop the environmental assessment and bring it into the process that way rather than waiting for the responsible government unit to do so. And the second one is the change in venue from the district courts to the Court of Appeals for the first appeal of litigation, other court action. We're more than happy to work on those two issues. We think those are issues that will come forward through the legislative forum, and we think that's the second step in this conversation. We think the third step is really going to be triggered by the legislative auditor's report. We look forward with great anticipation to the legislative auditor's report. It's my understanding that the legislative auditor will be delivering that in later part of February, that there's a dozen or 14 case studies. I know that the agency staff that have been providing information to the auditor over the last year on those studies say that there's some, really good case studies of this whole issue and the whole process that will be described and discussed in there. And I'm hopeful that we will find out what the barriers are, where the opportunities are for, further reforms to the system. And then the last of the four steps is in talking to some of the people who, 20, 30 years ago were some of the architects of some of the language that has created the law that drives this area. They're thinking there might be some more systemic reviews that we need to do. So I envision the agency at a minimum, hopefully with a lot of other partners, sitting down with a group of smart people who know this stuff inside and out and looking at it yet again from an even broader perspective than the legislative auditor did. And I anticipate we would bring some ideas forward over the course of the next year or two as we flesh those out. So, Mr. Chair, if that is sufficient for an intro, I'd leave it there and answer whatever questions I can.
Thank you. That's just fine for right now. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Davis, Senator Davis.
Commissioner Austin, do you know what basis you're going to use to determine if you're meeting the goal or not, as far as what percents or anything like that? Have you done anything on that, or where is that at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, the agencies over the last couple years, you know, this is not a new conversation. The speed of permitting, the responsiveness, both from the regulated community and from the EPA, quite frankly, you know, they also look at how we operate because we operate as a delegated authority from the federal level. So that the tracking mechanisms to figure out how fast the agency is responding to environmental review and to permitting have been developed slowly over the last couple of years. The agency has information on speed and on responsiveness. It's not universal across all of our permitting activities. The agency staff are unhappy with the level of sophistication of some of their ability, as well as, sister agencies. The DNR is a big player in this along with us, so ensuring we have a system that works for both is something that's being worked on right now. So we do have the initial ability to benchmark and to measure, and we are improving that as we go. Currently, the shortest in comparison to the 150-day goal that's in the executive order and in Senate File 1, the shortest time frames that we're working in around that issue and that determination are about 44 days. The median is about 180 days, and some of the long-standing ones are about 600 days. And what the governor has asked us to do is to try to shoot for 150 on all those, and where we have to deviate from 150 days to explain why. And I think all of us know and agree who have been around this conversation that routine determinations should happen quickly. Sometimes very big, very complex projects are going to take longer. And as long as we know and understand what's driving that, it'll help us make decisions about the reasonableness of those time frames in that context.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Austin, I just have a question related to the way the language is now. We have it as goal. And from your perspective, if we change that more to it's a requirement or you shall do or the report, how would that change it from your perspective?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I think it depends on how it's changed from a goal to something else. One of the factors that we are very concerned about as this conversation moves forward is automatic approvals that are in statute. That causes great conflict with federal law. So if that were changed to an automatic approval at 150 days, if the agency doesn't take action, for example, that would be a very serious issue for us to have a discussion about. I can tell you that whether it's called a goal or a target or, you know, something you're striving to achieve, the agency staff already think of it as being their benchmark. And I think that is triggering the kind of thoughtful response that we would hope it would.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thanks for coming. I've actually been working on some legislation that I think will be helpful in the agency's meeting this 150-day goal. I think it would be helpful if there was a lead agency. And I think the lead agency should be responsible for putting together a timeline of actions. I think that'll help drive this toward a shortening. And so in the somewhat near future, hopefully you will be back and we'll be continuing this discussion if the chair is willing to give me hearings on some of these initiatives. But I just wanted to mention to you that there are people that are working and thinking on mechanisms to help the agencies meet these 150-day timelines. Because, to be honest with you, members, I think if we just say, okay, make a decision in X days, more often than not, the decision will probably be no. And we don't want that to be the outcome. We want to have a thoughtful decision that is the best for all of us. So if you have thoughts on that or, you know, input, feel free to let me know, because I am working on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoey, we'll take you up on that offer, and we'll have a meeting soon. That's very helpful. Thank you. We'd love to have that conversation.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. And I might add, too, I really appreciate, and the committee should know this, that Commissioner Osland, as well as the DNR commissioner, the new Commissioner Landwehr, met with, took the time to meet with leadership, myself and the House leaders, on this particular issue, and that's what precipitated the governor's order, and we certainly appreciate that. So I look forward to working with you in the future.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have a joint presentation from the DNR and the PCA on permitting and environmental review. Presenters Larry Kramka from the DNR, as well as Jeff Smith from the PCA. Welcome to the committee, and whoever wants to go first you can make that decision way on the other end, and just introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the PCA. With me is Larry Kramka, who is the Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'll be going off starting today, and Larry will be finishing up. It's our pleasure to be here today to talk to you about this important couple of processes, I think, as a way to kick off the conversation. I think I'd just first like to acknowledge that we understand the importance of environmental review and permitting for businesses in Minnesota. We understand our role as supporting growth and jobs and business, and we are excited about being part of that. We've worked very hard over the last 10 years in particular to try and streamline our permitting environmental review processes, and I think I'll have some information later on in the presentation to show that. We also acknowledge that there's more to do, and we're excited to work with you and folks, both the business and the communities, to help us improve those processes.
Don't know. No. We'll do it that way.
today teamwork already.
Right. There you go. That's what we need.
Today, quickly, our presentation will cover the basics of permitting and environmental review. We're going to talk about process improvement and streamlining activities. We're going to show you some results and the data that we've achieved over the last few years. Talk a little bit about the priorities and how we set them. And then Larry will specifically discuss some of the DNR activities related to the mining sector. Before going much further, I just take a pause here and remind the committee about the MPCA's mission, working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. I'll also mention here that this task is much like walking on a tightrope. We often find ourselves in the middle of the regulated community who would like us to move faster, make decisions faster, resolve issues faster. And then on the other side, we've got a very active and engaged public and environmental community that would like us to make sure that we're protecting the environment and oftentimes move slower. And I'll tell you, if you've not experienced being in the middle of that, it's an odd feeling to be told that we are on a particular project, that we are moving way too fast, that we need to slow down and consider the environmental impacts, take some more time, and have another conversation that will say that you're going way too slow. You need to speed things up. And the same happens on the environmental side. The perspective that we are not, we're not applying the federal and state environmental regs properly, that we ought to be doing more to protect the environment, and then same conversation later on in the day is often that we are we're over-regulating. So it's a tough balancing act for us to try and manage. A little bit about a permitting authority. As Commissioner Austin said, Our authority comes from the federal programs, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, RCRA, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. These are the federal regs that drive the state's programs. For the most part, we try to mirror those activities. To be a delegated state for these federal programs, there's some things that we must do, that including writing our own laws and statutes that allow us to take the delegation. And when we do that, it's also a commitment by the agencies that we will be at least as strict as the federal agencies. We can go stricter, but we have to at least meet their floor. As Commissioner Austin also noted, that we are often subject to audits, annual audits, regular audits from all those programs, from our friends at EPA who come in and tell us how we're doing. So that is also part of the commitment to be a delegated state. One of the things I'll mention is that keep in mind that if we were not a delegated state, the conversations that the permittees would be having, the regulated community, and the citizens would be having would be out of Region 5 headquarters in Chicago. And for those of you that have worked with the federal government, if you think we're tough, if you think we're strict, if you think we're slow, you know how that is. So we think that's a good thing, and that the state has delegation for these programs. A couple other things that we get benefited from by being a delegated state is that we are able to provide, if there's ambiguity in the federal regs, we're able to provide some clarity through our state statutes and rules. And we also have the courts and decisions through our legislature to clarify and kind of focus in on issues that are Minnesota-specific. So that's a luxury that we think provides flexibility and nimbleness to both the regulated community and the citizens. A little bit about the kind of permits we issue, air, water, and land. Air permits, such things as the big power plants, refineries, down to the little mom-and-pop shops, dry cleaners, platers, those sorts of businesses. Water covers such things as the Metropolitan Council, pig's eye, the old pig's eye wastewater plant, 300 million gallons a day, down to small stormwater facilities. Land, we're talking about landfills, hazway storage processing facilities, and large above-ground storage tanks. All told, we've got a universe of regulated parties, permits greater than 15,000. And it depends how you add it up, but it's at least 15 and can be closer to 20,000. So people are often surprised at the number of permits that the PCA and the DNR regulate and that we're in charge of. And I think that's an important piece to keep in mind as we discuss the rest of the, or go through the rest of the presentation.
Excuse me. Senator Peterson has a question.
Sir, thank you, Chair. One question I had is, as long as we're on this subject relating to water, you know, we've all heard many reports in regard to the water permitting and the number of agencies applicants need to go through. And could you comment on whether that's correct or not? And then the second part of that question would be, why wouldn't we just allow the most local unit of government? For example, the city of St. Cloud has a full-time staff person for stormwater. Why wouldn't we just let that lowest or most local inspector or employee for that local municipality handle all the stormwater issues in the municipality of St. Cloud, for example?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think good questions. I think to answer the second one first, we often are trying to push down decision-making as our state statutes and rules allow down to the local units of government. We've got joint powers agreements, and we are often trying to get the counties in particular to take on more of an active role. Oftentimes it is possible for us as a state to meet federal commitments by using both state inspectors and inspections along with the county folks. So while it is our desire to try and push down that local level of decision-making, oftentimes we are restricted by the levels of and the what our rules and statutes allow us to do. So I would say the biggest factor for that is we are not allowed to through rules and statutes.
Mr. Smith, if you would, for me, trying for me to get my head around the removal and disposition, the disposal of foundations, concrete foundations, underground tanks. Maybe you can go into that just a little bit. Do you work with the Department of Ag? If you have some underground storage, can you just give a little flavor as to what would happen if you had something like that?
Mr. Chair, for underground storage tanks, they're generally governed by Minnesota rules, and there are typically not permits issued at the state level for the disposal or removal of those particular tanks. We cover the bigger tanks, 1 million gallons and above. Everything else is done by rule.
Okay, so there's a threshold there for that particular.
Yeah. But we do, for a certain amount of, we are the delegated authority for the inspection of underground storage tanks at certain gas stations, refineries. We do inspections for those, and for the most part, we've got an obligation to try and inspect those. Every tank in the state at facilities that are covered under that rule every 3 years. That's our federal commitment.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Smith, to follow up on Senator Peterson's question, do the cities, counties really have the capacity to issue these permits as far as the testing and all the technical services that you have at your disposal? Can you just talk about that a little bit? And they're all facing funding cuts as well, so that's another issue as we move forward, I think. But
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that's an important issue. We certainly are not trying to force anybody to take a program that they're not comfortable taking, nor do they have the resources for it. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we'll invite, especially in the 7-county, 10-county metro area, as well as places like Duluth and Rochester. Our goal would be to partner with them and operate under a federal or state program and have them be part of the conversation. So while it's not transferring authority or and we often have tools that they do not in terms of compliance and enforcement and timely responses in terms of not discovering noncompliance.
Just to follow up so the bigger cities have the capacity, but how about the rest of the state, the rural and townships, et cetera, that also need to follow the rules?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that's an important issue and one that we understand that the local units of government is struggling with. Yep.
So you're providing that service?
For the most part, if it's in our purview, if we've got the rules and regs to cover it, we are in charge of it.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like from your perspective, you know, being a leader within the department there, is that something you would try and encourage? Would you encourage local units of government or provide a forum that would help them take that on, or is that something you would oppose?
We are always, Mr. Chair, Senator, we are always open to partnering with local units of government, whether it's townships, counties, watershed districts. If we can find people to help us do the job, for the most part, my experience is that we all are interested in the same things. We have, in terms of environmental protection, we have different rules that allow us certain flexibilities. And so if we can take advantage of all those pieces, we have found that is a much more effective use of the programs, and there's a synergy gained by using the resources of local units of government.
All right, thanks.
Go ahead.
Moving on to permit contents, very quickly, I think it's an important message here is to understand that these permits that we issue are not like driver's licenses, fishing licenses, local building permits. At the agencies, we have employed engineers and soil scientists, hydrologists, biologists, and it's a very technical group because the permits that we cover and issue are very technical by nature. Our job, as defined through federal reg and state reg, is to ensure that whatever is designed to treat the pollution has a reasonable chance of operating. So it's not like you fill out an application, sign it, pay the money, and send it in. Our job is to work with the consultants and the project proposers to make sure that whatever they design, whatever they put in the ground, whatever is emitting the pollution has a chance to meet the limits that are set to be protective of human health and the environment. A little bit about the permits themselves. We've got some descriptions. These are all required through the federal regs. So this is not the length. Some people talk about the length of the permit. And while the permits can often be, you know, several dozen pages long, they all have to have these pieces. And so describing the owner and operator, the location of the facility, the description of the site, what are they making, what are they doing there, the pollution control equipment that's applicable to the facility. The permit must also describe the effluent or emission limits that apply to the facility. Among that, and the next step is to make sure that they are clear on what they need to report to the PCA or the DNR through reporting requirements. And then finally, it's the stuff that we often call boilerplate, and that is a paring down of the very lengthy federal and state statutes into a more meaningful piece that the regulated party can understand and go through and use on a daily basis. Types of permits that we issue. Two main types. One is an individual permit. This is one permit covering one facility. All of our permits go through a public notice period. This is an important piece set out by the federal regs that cover air, water, and land facilities. By definition, this was meant to be a public process. It's a we often talk about it as a contract between the regulated party, the governing agencies, and the public. And because that's the case, we need to be all clear about what's in this permit. We need to agree on it. And the public notice allows the agencies to take in input from concerned citizens, environmental groups, either for or against a particular project. So an individual permit typically covers a specific facility because it is more complicated. They've got a certain kind of treatment facility. They're located in a particularly sensitive area. And because so, we need to craft language and requirements that are specific to that facility in a single permit. General permits is a single permit covering a number of facilities, and typically it can be from a dozen to many thousands of facilities. The benefit to this particular permit is that we get to do one public notice for this general permit ahead of final issuance, and then facilities will apply for coverage under the general permit. So if you meet the minimum qualifications, as described in your application, you get automatic coverage, and the permit is issued often within a couple of days to a couple of weeks. So in terms of timeliness and efficient turnaround, this is the kind of the golden ring for us in that we get to issue many, many permits very, very quickly. I think one thing I also mention here is that because this is so efficient and effective in terms of protecting the environment and getting permits out quickly, we've got about 75% of our total permits of about the 15,000 that are covered under general permits right now. So this is a tool that we continue to explore and want to use as much as we possibly can. A little bit about the permitting process. The first step here on this slide is submit application, but actually if you're an individual permit holder or you're looking to receive an individual permit, there's a step before this, and that is the pre-public notice conversation that you have with the agency, DNR. And it's a way for us to scope a project and get ready for identifying places where there might be holdups. If they have not thought the project through, this is a chance for us to say, have you thought about this? It's a good chance, and we'll have as many of these as people want to have to get ready for the submittal of the application. And we found that this particular tool is very helpful in identifying pitfalls in the future and probably cuts off time at the end of the permitting process. Following that, we've got the submit application piece. Following the application, we will review it to see if it's complete. And if you're a general permit applicant, if you meet those minimum qualifications and we agree with you, then we'll issue your permit again within a couple of days to a couple of weeks. If you're an individual permit holder, then we go on to the next step. Sometimes that involves environmental review, which I'll touch on briefly in just a second. There's the public notice piece for individual permits. And then there's also a couple of pieces that may or may not be included in the process. One is the public meeting. That is where we actually go out to the community, discuss the proposed project. Usually it happens in the middle of the public notice period, and we allow for people to ask specific questions face-to-face with agency staff, and we'll collect comments at that time.
Mr. Smith, Senator Gazalkos.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, on the applications, do we ever notify the person that submitted it if it's not complete? I've heard stories about it sitting there for a while and never really hearing anything. So I want to know what the process is there. And then secondly, are we looking at doing the forms electronically where it won't be sent in unless it's complete?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, great questions. The answer is, for some of our media programs, we do that. Our goal in moving on to the future will be to do the review of completeness within 14 days. Our AIR program right now does reviews all the applications within about 10 days for it's administratively complete, and then a quick look to see if it's technically complete. There's always, especially on the AIR side, there's always some missing information, some information that needs to be clarified. But our first cut is to get back to them on the AIR side within 10 days or 2 weeks to let them know that what we've got is good enough. We're going to send it, or not good at all, we're going to send it back to you, or you're missing a few key pieces, we'll hold on to it till you get us the missing information. We absolutely need to be better about doing that across all of our media programs. And one of our commitments, as we've reviewed the executive order, is that in order for us to make that, we need to be very efficient about doing application review, so it's going to be critical. Second question was about electronic submittal of applications. Right now, we've got about four of our general permits that we do accept electronic applications, and this is a piece that we've been exploring now for a few years, absolutely critical for us to be able to take those applications. It benefits the regulated community because they get to submit something electronically. It benefits the agency because we get to take information directly from the application. It gets fed into our database and our systems automatically without having to do kind of transpose the information. We have errors that often come when people are moving information from, you know, keying it into another database. There's a chance for error there. So this is a key piece for us. The challenge is that our current systems do not always allow that to happen. So we've got some work to do on the IT side.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. And Mr. Smith, in those meetings you described in getting the applicant ready to submit an application, do you think your staff at that time, are they being clear with the applicant? Is that, you know, this is currently has been a very open-ended process, and, you know, clearly, again, what we hear. I can't imagine what you guys must go through reading about your so-called failures in the paper all the time or whenever it's brought up in a case like this. But, you know, what we're hearing, whether it's true or not, is that the process has been open-ended with no end. Has your staff been making an effort to try and tell the applicants that that's what they're dealing with as the process has started?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. One of our goals is to identify, as we have gone through many, many thousands of projects over the years, one of our goals is to identify places where we think this permit will get held up, whether it's technical issues, whether it's a concerned citizenry, whether it's EPA looking at the permit with some questions about it. One of the things that we do, I think, very well is to tell folks where the pitfalls are. We may disagree on exactly that their issues are not, and those issues may or may not come to light when we get towards the end of the permitting process. But I think we are very clear, and I would suggest that the permittees appreciate, while they may not appreciate the length of time it takes to get the permit through, I would be surprised that very many of them would say that they were at least notified that from our staff that could have been a problem.
Follow up, yeah, Mr. Smith. You know, one of the things I asked the commissioner in the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, which I didn't ask today because I had asked him all my questions already in that meeting, was that if he had heard about specific examples of people that he'd like to call or like to see the staff call right away and reassure them, you know, that their permit's being looked at and will be given some attention and that type of thing. He didn't really have any, which I can understand from his perspective. But I'm guessing through this process we're going to hear from some applicants that have been experiencing this. I mean, do you feel like your staff has it documented that they were very clear in these meetings, pre-application meetings, that those applicants were told that this could be, you know, a very open-ended process? I mean, is that something you guys are documenting, or?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. I think we could be very clear. One of our efforts over the last couple of years has been to make sure that we are documenting the conversations we have. So, again, the outcome is always frustrating, especially when it feels like it's out of the hands of the permittee, and oftentimes it's out of the hands of the PCA as well. But I can promise you that for the vast majority of projects, they know exactly what they're getting into.
Good. Thank you.
Senator Sway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Smith, before you move on to the environmental review, this isn't the first legislation that's been drafted around here trying to figure out a way to timelines on these permits. I had this a number of years ago, and Commissioner Moore and I had a lengthy discussion. But one of the problems that we discussed was the fact that we require Minnesota both the construction and the operational permit at the same time. And we had some discussion at that point that the department was going to work to try to get these permits working side by side as opposed to doing one and then the other to try to shorten up the timeline. And I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about the issue of the construction and the operational permits and if you've been able to shorten that timeline up by doing both at the same point.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that's you've highlighted actually a place where we think we actually provide some additional service to the regulated community. Many states don't have separate programs and try to do all these things at once. Minnesota's program allows us to build construction permits and then roll in the Title Fives. The reissuance is later on. It doesn't mean we have to. It just means that as time allows and the situation calls for, we get to work on those and roll them in as one action. I think my position is that I think that's been – there's some flexibility in there that other states do not have because we have that program. One of the things that we've been trying to do to address your specific concern is to say, do we need to roll in all the Title V issues at that time when we do a construction permit? And the answer is no. So what we're trying to do is balance the pressures from our EPA big brother watching over our shoulder, who is driving us to do Title V reissuances very quickly, keep up with our backlog. Our pushback and things that we'll continue to do in the future is to say, okay, we're going to work on only the Title Fives that make sense during this construction reissuance project. So I think we're going to get to a little more focused work as we continue to drive towards construction as being our number one priority.
Please continue.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about environmental review. I think you've probably heard this conversation a few times already. This is MEPA, the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, enacted in 1974. Probably not a new governor or commissioner goes by where there's not some proposal to try and streamline this. My 20 years at the agency, every 3, 4, or 5 years, we're doing some other report investigating this particular issue. So we know that it's been looked at quite often over the years. I'll just refresh the committee's knowledge that environmental review is driven by the Environmental Quality Board. It's not a PCA, it's not a DNR, it's not a Department of Transportation program. We are simply the responsible governmental units like townships and counties are in this process. It's important to understand that the purpose of environmental review is purely to inform the decision makers, the public, and the project proposers. It is not a place to make a decision about the validity of a project. We don't, whatever decision comes out of EAWs or EISs is not there for a decision about the project itself. It's there only to inform those permitting processes. Again, it's a source of information integrated with the permitting process. And there are many RGUs down to watershed districts and local units of government, as well as state agencies. A couple of mechanisms for the two main mechanisms for environmental review and environmental assessment worksheet and the environmental impact statement. The EAW is the one that's used more frequently. It's a standard form used by all the RGUs from watershed districts up to state agencies. The same set of 31 questions, and the decision point for the EAW is whether the project has potential for significant environmental impact. If the answer to that question is yes, it'll typically move on to an environmental impact statement, an EIS. If the answer is no, it can proceed to permitting with the understanding that comments received will be integrated into those permits. The EIS follows the EAW. It's a detailed analysis of environmental impacts. It includes additional considerations such as the alternatives analysis, including the no-build option, and it looks at socioeconomic effects as well. The decision point for the EIS is whether it's adequate or not. A little bit of information on the numbers and EAWs that we've done. The graph you see here is for the years 2008 and 2009. On the left-hand side of the graph, you can see where the MPCA, the DOT, and the DNR have had projects. I think the point that I'd like to emphasize here is that state agencies only did 35% of the projects. The rest were done, the other 65% were done by local units of government. And those are up on the right side of that graph, city, county, watershed districts, townships, and others. For those 2 years, 2008 and 2009, there were 99 different RGUs on only three state agencies. So you get a sense of the number of people that play in this environmental review arena. Quickly, another graph, difficult to read, but the message here is that there are a number of projects that fall under the purview of environmental review, from campgrounds, highways, sports facilities, transmission lines. For the most part, the PCA operates in only three of these, and they're highlighted in green: wastewater treatment facilities, feedlots, fuel conversion facilities, and landfills. The rest are managed by usually local units of government.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka, question.
Mr. Smith, I'm sorry, can I get a copy of this? I can't read it at all. I'd love to get a copy of that. And then secondly, of these reviews, how many get turned down? I mean, do you have a percentage? You must have some sense of when a project goes through this, which how many make it and how many don't?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the way you get into the environmental review process is by tripping a threshold. So if you're going to do something in a certain place of a certain type, then you're required to do the EAW. There's not really a turn down. You just have to go through the process, and either you move on to EISs or the EAW was significant.
Follow-up. I guess I meant the EIS.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator, we do the state does approximately 8 to 10 EISs in total each year. And for the state agencies, we do, one or two every other year. So to answer your question, most of them stop at the end of the EAW process.
Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Smith, is that because of the cost factor of the EIS and the projects just stop?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, the project doesn't stop. It just did not reach the threshold of being determined to be a significant potential for environmental harm. So the AW will inform that permit, and if it's determined that it's not potential for significant environmental harm, then that's the environmental review stops, and decisions are made at the permitting level. If it's determined that it is a potential for significant environmental harm, then it moves on to the EIS level, and there the adequacy is determined.
Mr. Chair, to Senator Gazilka's question then, but how many of them get to the EAW point and they recognize that there is not enough information to determine that they're not an environmental problem because of that? So then they should, if they're going to go forward, they have to become an EIS. The proposers look at the cost of the EIS and things just come to a halt at that point because of the cost.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have a sense of how many projects might hit that breaking point. I think for the most part, the cost piece is figured out or figured into the equation early on in the process. And the EAW, by definition, is an iterative process. So conversations go back and forth between, you know, the regulated community, the permittee, and the RGU. So I guess we could track that down, and we'll try to get back to you with a more definitive answer.
Continue, please.
Jeff. Mr. Chair. Members, Larry Kramka, Assistant Commissioner DNR. To answer your question, Senator Skoy, I think very few stop in the way that you're describing them. Most people that get into environmental review already know they're in for that process. So once they get to the point where they're doing an EAW or they're doing an EIS, they're in it for the long haul. I know that in the experience I've had out in the field, I can only think of one EAW that I can recall over the years that led to an EIS decision, and the company then decided not to go forward with the project. I'm sure there are others out there, but generally speaking, I think the environmental review process isn't for the faint of heart, and the companies that get into it know that, and so they're trying to answer all the questions to try to get to an answer that the project has an adequate EAW and has an adequate EIS. But there is another part of that that is problematic, and that is if you're doing an EAW with the idea that you want to stay out of getting an EIS determination at the end of that line, I think the EAW becomes much more involved up front by the companies who are trying to then answer questions that maybe aren't even in front of them today to try to cover every base that might pop up.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kramka, because you're from Bemidji, we might be thinking about the same one.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think we are.
Thank you. Continue.
Mr. Chair, committee, we'll move on to process improvement. As I described, this has been a key part of our ability to issue permits in a more timely fashion over the last 5 years in particular. While we've always been focused on trying to make our processes move better and faster and be more efficient, it really has been over the last 8 or 10 years that this has been more of a cultural experience for the PCA. That was the result of having a commissioner at the time that came from business, and her push was the drive of the Six Sigma project into the agency. From there, we've really taken that to heart, and there is almost no process that we have within the agency that has not gone through an evaluation and an improvement, kind of gone through improvement steps. So this has been an exciting piece for us because we have seen the results of it, and we continue to use all the business and process improvement tools that are out there, Lean, Kaizen, Six Sigma, et cetera. A little bit about the process improvements that are underway. We've got some low-risk permitting. Again, this is sort of batch permitting, trying to identify similar permits that are out there and get them to the right permit writers to reissue quickly and issue quickly. We've got general permits. Again, always exploring opportunities for new general permits. We've been using electronic tools more efficiently. We talked a little bit about the electronic submission of applications and documents. That's an important piece for us. We'll continue to try and use all these electronic mechanisms to speed up our process times. And as Commissioner Austin indicated, we've got the Office of Legislative Auditors finalizing report, and we expect to learn a great deal from them about other ways that we can improve these processes. Permit timeliness.
Oops.
That's good. Again, this is kind of a snapshot right now of the time it would take to issue a permit in each of the media areas. We've talked about 150 days as a goal. We've already had for about 8 years a goal of issuing permits within 180 days. And for the most part, we're able to do that. We also have a desire to keep our permit backlog down below 10%. And for most of our programs, that we also are achieving that. Again, quick graph indicating permit timeliness. This is a snapshot of the year's applications we received and permits we've issued for five-year periods. You can look at the data. We'll make this available as the letter, numbers are very small, but I'd point your attention to the slope of the graph, and I think that's the telling kind of piece here, that we have gone from an overall permit issuance time of 205 days in 2005 to about 69 days in 2009. With that said, we can do better, and we intend to. One more slide here on the graph. We've got environmental review timeliness. Again, this is a 2001 to 2009 time period. This is showing the time it takes us to get EAWs out the door. Again, the slope of the graph indicating that we certainly are getting faster, more efficient. Is the message I'll leave you with. And then my final slide is to talk about how we set priorities. We've always had construction business permits as being our number one priority. I will often move staff away from reissuances when a high-profile construction project comes in. We understand that we are supporting, as I said before, Minnesota business, jobs, and growth. We've always understood that, and that's why it's always been a priority for us, even more so these days as we struggle with the issues that we are struggling with in terms of budget. While that's a great story, so your question might be, well, then I'm confused. How can the PCA have a priority for business and construction permits, and then you hear so much about our failings in that area? One of the things I want to point out here is that all construction projects are not created equal. It's important to understand, as I've listed here, that for the most part, I'd say 90 to 95% of the construction business permits that are out there, we issue within a couple of days to a few months. And the ones that really make that happen are our use of general permits. I've got a couple examples here. We've got about 3,500 air registration and general permits. These permits cover in the urban areas. These are our dry cleaners, small shops, mechanics, small manufacturing facilities that comply with our general permit requirements. In other words, their emission sources are within a certain confined type and area such that they can qualify for a general permit, and we can reissue them very quickly. In this case, usually within 14 days of receiving a completed application, we are issuing these permits. Another example of business construction permits are our construction stormwater permits. Again, these are for facilities an acre or larger, disturbing an acre or more of soil. We get about 2,800 of these, 1,500 to 2,800 of these every year. These are for developments. They are building shops. They are building businesses. Again, these are woodworkers, mechanics, carpenters, And again, the kind of businesses that I think you folks are interested in supporting. So, you know, for us, this is a really important piece, and the message that needs to get out there is that for, again, 95% of the businesses that are looking for permits, the agency is issuing these permits within a couple of days to a couple of months. So then your next question might be, well, then what are the ones we're hearing about? What are the ones that make it to our ears as legislators, or they find their way into the paper? And my message for you today is that's actually a very, very small number of facilities. It's in the neighborhood of maybe 20 to 30 a year. It doesn't mean that they're not important. It doesn't mean we need to improve on those. But it actually is a very small number of facilities in total. And I'll give you an example of the work we did last fall to try to get to understanding this particular issue. We began to look across the program at facilities that had been in-house, all the media programs, greater than 150 days. So of the 15,000 facilities, we discovered that about 640 permits were in-house over 150 days, so roughly around 4%. We then began to parse and look that list down and look at how many of those are construction and business permits. And based on our assessment, we're talking about 84 facilities. So less than 0.5% of the facilities that we issue, the permits that we issue, are over 150 days old. The rest of them are less than that or they're current. My reason for bringing this up is, one, to give you a sense about the support that we provide to Minnesota businesses already through good permit timeliness. And it's also to maybe help us focus our attention and our energy and our limited resources on those permits that I think represent the ones that make it to your ears and make it to the level of the press and to concern for our timeliness. The number is actually probably around, like I said, 84 to 100 total facilities. And those are the ones that we need to focus our attention on. And my concern is that if we spend energy trying to rebuild this entire car, that's going to take away time from our ability to work on the ones that are really important to you. Unfortunately, the ones that are really important are also, and the ones that you hear about, are the largest, the most controversial, involve multimedia, so they cross air, water, and land permitting programs. They've got citizenry that is active and oftentimes opposed to the project. Sometimes it's because they don't understand it. Sometimes it's, you know, not in my backyard issues. Sometimes it's legitimate environmental and human health concerns. Those are the ones that you guys hear about the most. Those are the ones that we need to tackle and think about process improvement because, for the most part, I think we're doing very well on the ones that we issue within a couple of months. So, with that piece, I look forward to working with you on those smaller, finite group of facilities, and I'll turn it over to my colleague for more on the mining industry.
Thank you for that report, Mr. Smith. And members, you should know that I think we'll be talking about these issues here in the near future, and probably some of those percentages that you have, number of facilities that have probably got some more time on them. You'll have those available for us the next time we come back. So. Well, thank you for the great overview. Next, Mr. Kramko, DNR. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is a good opportunity to go through some things that the statute that you're going to be looking at, or the legislation you're going to be looking at, will change. This is a topic that, as we've already mentioned earlier, has come up probably over and over and over again, not only with the legislature, but with the agencies and the regulated community out there, is how quickly we can move projects through all of these different environments that we have out there. So in order to frame out some of this, we thought that it would be important to bring something that's not very complicated, always done on time, and very, very easy to understand, and that would be the metallic mining side of the equation and environmental review. to try to give you some backdrop, from 2005 to date, I'm going to just run you through a number of EISs that have been in the queue and how they've processed along. I want you to keep in mind two important dates. The one is the date of the adequacy determination. That's the end point of an EIS. But the other one is the beginning point of an EIS, and that's the publishing of that scoping document or the scoping EAW. The reason that I want to draw the attention to those two things is to get to a scoping EAW, these are projects that typically come in the door already needing an EIS. So the graph that Jeff showed you earlier saying, you know, you have an EAW, that goes through a process which then leads to a decision on whether or not to do an EIS. These ones come in the door already needing an EIS. So the EAW process is really used as a scoping tool to say, let's get a handle on what the real issues are going to be around this mine site and make sure that the EIS covers those things. The EAW, that same questionnaire, is used basically as a tool to try to identify those things. Oftentimes, there are months to years by the companies in advance of getting to that scoping EAW of work to really try to determine what their project's going to look like and what the impacts might be. So from the standpoint of the industry, they are oftentimes working with the agencies much in advance of actually getting to that scoping EAW being published. And so when you hear some of these extended timelines, keep in mind they've been talking to the agencies for a long time often, and it feels like they're in environmental review because they're asking and answering a lot of those same questions leading up to that time. So just to walk you through the ones that have happened since 2005, ArcelorMittal expansion, that was begun in June of 2005. That's that scoping EAW, was completed in 2007. All of these generally are joint federal-state EISs, meaning there is a federal agency that has a permitting requirement on the project, and that federal agency actually is also required to do an EIS. The state has a provision within the rules that allows the state agencies to work with the federal agencies to reduce duplication, not do two separate EIS processes, but bring them together and allow us to actually produce one single document that both the federal government and the state can use to get to those adequacy determinations. Minnesota Steel EIS, again, that one was begun in July of 2005 and completed in 2007. That's a new mine, a direct reduced iron plant and steel mill. That was a joint EIS with the Corps of Engineers. PolyMet, one that you know about and have heard about, no doubt. This is the first entry into the environmental review process on the non-ferrous side of mining. That project, actually, the scoping EAW was published in June of 2005 as well. So there's a lot of activity, as you can see, happening all right around that same timeline. The draft EIS, in this case, was actually published in 2009. That, again, is another joint federal-state EIS. Moving to some additional projects that have occurred, the U.S. Steel Keetac Expansion EIS. That project went into the scoping phase in September of 2008 and was completed just in December of 2010. That is an expanded mine and the restart of a production line at the Keetac facility. Again, you'll see the common culprits here, the Corps of Engineers and the state doing those joint EISs. Mesabi Nugget is a plant that is going to be producing iron nuggets. That project has been in progress. This is one of those places where the company's been doing a lot of work with the agencies for a long time. We've been trying to get really a good handle on what all of the site issues are and what the things are that are going to need to be put into that EIS. That project is at a place where I'm sorry, I don't have a date on when that will actually enter into the next phase. But that is an ongoing project. That is a unique site as well because it is a brownfield site. It's the former LTV project site, and it's right next to PolyMet. SR Steel. SR Steel is the predecessor of the Minnesota Steel EIS that you had out there. They have now come in and entered into the process of expanding their facility, which led to a supplemental EIS requirement. In this case, because their footprint of the actual overall site is not going to significantly change, this will only be a state EIS. This project, again, was originally noticed in March of 2010. We are not at a place yet where that's actually gone out for that scoping EAW.
Excuse me, I got a question. Senator Kielash?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Anyhow, when you were working with the Mesabi Nugget, and because that's new technology coming in, is the relationship more cooperative and trying to find out what environmental things they need to do before they start building this, or how does that permitting work within the agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not exactly sure I understand your question, so I'll try to answer it this way, and then you can correct me if that doesn't go the right way. The way that I would describe it is that most of the companies that are coming into the environmental review process at this time, again, through the EIS process, they have some fairly complicated projects. Mesabi Nugget's not a simple project like the other taconite facilities that we have a number of. It is the first of its kind. It is involving a lot of new technology and a lot of new things. So they've been very cooperative in trying to get to not only identifying some of the problems with the site and the project, but also with trying to find those solutions that, you know, may address environmental concerns.
Just to follow up. Yeah, and I guess one of my thoughts are is that your staff needs to get up to speed, I would guess, on the technology that they're doing to understand what the potential problems could be with that would be different than a regular taconite processing site or whatever. And I'm just wondering, is that part of the review process? Does that happen as the EIS is taking place?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it happens along the way in a number of different ways. The thing that I would describe about the Mesabi Nugget project is because it's a brownfield site, there are some things that are unique to that facility that are not present on a place where you may be starting a mine from scratch. Some of those things may or may not have been fully understood walking into the project, and when you run into those places where you get a hiccup or something that is unexpected, oftentimes it ripples back through much of the rest of the things that you've already done. For instance, if you have a problem with geochemistry on the site, so how the rocks, you know, behave underwater, you have to then go back and rethink all of the rest of the things that are connected and related to that water balance and the water budget. It has those ripple effects in all of the modeling and in all of the other decisions that you have to make. So sometimes a very simple, small item can have significant delays pop up in other parts because you thought you answered all the questions, and now you got to go back and redo those.
Thank you.
So the required review, in most cases, and I will certainly not say that in every case will a metallic mining project require a federal and state EIS, but for most of them, especially those that have surface features, that will happen. In most cases, these facilities exist in places where there are a lot of wetlands. The wetland impacts are what trigger the Corps of Engineers as the main federal agency that are involved. We, in all cases, try and will seek to do these joint state-federal EISs so that we reduce the duplication. We make sure that the company is able to actually have all of the questions answered in one place instead of having, you know, dueling documents out there that may answer questions differently or be perceived differently. It does require these full federal National Environmental Policy Act is what NEPA is. That's the companion or the federal law that mimics the Minnesota standards around environmental review. In fact, Minnesota's law was in effect kind of modeled after the NEPA standards. Typically, the benefits here or the way that this plays out, the state actually, believe it or not, is better able to contract and receive money from the companies to hire the appropriate technical resources and contractors to do this kind of work. So the federal government benefits by us being able to provide that avenue. And we also, because we have our own environmental review statute, provide an awful lot of work in this process framework piece and really being able to keep projects on track. And I know that that's hard to believe when you have projects that are 6 years out, depending on your timeline. But we actually are in a better place to make sure that those things stay on track and keep moving through the process. We have the ability to hire staff that the federal government doesn't. So the Joint Environmental Review, the increased efficiency that comes from and reducing the total time and cost by being able to do all of those analysis together is real, and it does create places where you may have both agencies asking similar questions but not the same, but you would have to use the same tools to answer them. Now you can do it once. You can get them both done at the same time instead of having to do two different model runs, for instance, to get to that same question. But it does have some drawbacks, and one of those is that it does increase the complexity. If you can imagine having an EIS done by a single agency, which actually doesn't happen on mining projects anyway, because you automatically will have the pollution control agency involved because of their expertise on the water pollution side and air pollution side, the DNR, Department of Health for health effects of fibers and other things like that. And then now you throw in federal agencies with their bureaucracies, oftentimes not in state, scattered around the country coming in, it does create some added complexity. There are multiple lead agencies. In these cases, both the federal agency and the state agency that's the responsible government unit work together. They have joint lead, decision making. So you add the committee decision process to some of this. Different regulations and procedures in play between the federal and the state governments. Federal staffing limitations are a real issue in that they are not always staffed, as I said here, and nor are they always staffed in a way that they are able to respond in the same time fashion that we are with. The user paying for this process, the state's very responsive because they're paying for our time. And, we take that very seriously. We've also added in some increased roles by the environmental protection agencies in the process. That's added complexity. It's all under that same heading, isn't it? Federal cooperating agencies. These are federal agencies who aren't lead agencies but want to play in the arena of the EIS, and they want to at least be able to participate in some of the decision-making. It's an actual legal term to have this cooperating agency status, and it provides people kind of a special place at the table while an EIS is prepared. And then you have the tribal folks that are out there who are also in a unique spot because in some cases, not only are there treaty lands that are involved, ceded territories, but they also may have actual permits that are related to, water facilities on some of the same water bodies. So they also have the ability to come in. And again, it's just complexity adds time. No matter how you deal with it, you're sitting around a table with two people, you're going to get to a decision a lot faster than if you have 15 or 20. So what does MEPA do for NEPA?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Squire.
Mr. Chair, to that point of those multiple folks sitting around the table, I assume there's kind of one group or one primary agency that gets to say yes, but do all the rest of them kind of have veto power, or how does that work out?
Mr. Crafton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, in the case of a joint federal state EIS, there's at least two people that have the decision-making authority. It would be whoever those lead agencies are. They are able to say, we're going to do this or we're going to do that. The other folks that are out there as cooperating agents or, you know, other entities on the outside, as far as the NEPA or MEPA process, they don't necessarily have a veto. I won't get into the complexity of everything here. EPA does have some role around that that is similar to a veto. It doesn't sound like that when they say it, but
the effect is.
But that's generally the case. The lead agencies really are responsible, and their goal and their responsibility is to get an EIS that adequately addresses the impacts of a project, the mitigations for that project, and then leads to that decision that says they adequately addressed all of those things and looked at all of the appropriate stuff. So the state's role in this really, what we have found to date is that we provide that resource for federal agencies that they lack. We actually hire a project manager that tracks these projects through to completion. That person is paid for, again, by the proposer. So the company is paying for us to have that person who's dedicated to make their project move. We have technical staff oftentimes, especially on the mining side of things, that is at least as good, if not better, than many of the federal agencies that are involved. You do have a very robust set of agencies out there with expertise in hard rock mining, in waste characterization, in air quality, in water quality, and all of those things. That's dedicated staff that are not able to be replicated in many of the federal agencies that are out there. The last thing that that comes under this is that we are able to hire that contractor to help us put this all together. So the agencies don't have lots of staff that are able to just pick up an EIS when one walks in the door and march this through and write it, and especially on a very complex project like, you know, a large mine, we actually hire an outside consulting firm to help make sure that all of the right stuff is assembled, that it's readable, that it's put into the right format, that it's a document that meets all of the needs, and that they then become a second set of eyes to make sure that we're asking and answering all of the right questions for that federal and state process. On the funding side, the current statute requires that an EIS be paid for by the proposer. So all of that is basically funded through a grant or an income agreement with those companies that are proposing those projects. The last thing, again, that I know is hard to believe with what you hear is that the MEPA process, the state's process, really is the place where there is any real time commitment at all that's made in statute. The federal process does not have a requirement that it get done in any given amount of time. So a federal EIS by itself theoretically could take forever, and there would not be a statutory breach in doing that. The state process obviously has timelines, so when you match those up, the timelines get waived, in a sense, by the companies, because we have to be able to allow the federal process to go on. We're not going to get done in a 280-day time frame that's required by the state statute on EISs, but the state agencies recognize that that's the goal always, is that 280 days. We are actually able to then try to drive those federal processes to a quicker end and get us to a document sooner than later. So quickly going through the major elements of an environmental impact statement, some of these are self-explanatory. The proposed project description seems very obvious, but this really is the nuts and bolts of how EISs operate and what they have to look at. That proposed project description really has to be developed enough to be able to have the layperson pick it up and say, I think I know what they're going to do up there on that piece of ground. So from stockpiles to plant locations to plant meaning, you know, manufacturing facility locations to where the holes are going to be and how deep they are and all those kind of things. The other thing that it does is it lays out what are all of those different permits that are going to be required for this project so that people can see who's really going to be using this document at the end of the day. Because, again, EISs are there to inform the permit decision makers at the end of the process. Potential alternatives, that includes the kinds of things that are both feasible and practical. And that meet the project purpose. It's very important on the federal side that whatever alternatives are put on the table, that they actually meet the proposer's purpose, for putting the project forward. It's a way of trying to make sure that it's not just the entire universe out there of anybody, anything that can be thought up, but it's really what are the kinds of stuff that you really would think about doing as an alternative to the one that was proposed. It has to talk about the existing conditions. It has to then analyze the environmental, social, economic impacts of the project against those proposed actions, the alternatives, mitigations for any of those impacts that are identified, and also including those cumulative effects that are identified through that process. Preparation, again, I've touched on some of this stuff, goes through the scoping. That scoping uses that state scoping EAW. There is a decision document that comes out of that basically lays out what the project proposes to do and what the likely impacts are of that project. There's a public information meeting that follows that publishing. That's an opportunity for folks to come in, ask questions, make sure that they understand what the document is, but also what the project is about. There is a public comment period that then is associated with that. The public is allowed to basically weigh in. Did the scoping document hit all of the right things? Did it miss something? Did it overstate something? Did it understate something? And that then comes back to the lead agencies. In order to prepare that final scoping decision document, the agencies have to look at all those comments and say, did we get it right or did we miss something? Let's adjust our scope. Once we've done that, we publish it. That goes into both the state register and the EQB monitor, as well as then the federal notice goes out through the federal process. Typically, on the state side, a state EIS would then start a 280-day clock where basically the EIS is supposed to be completed within that time period. The proposer at that time is developing all of the information that's needed to answer and address all of those things that are done through that scoping process. The lead and cooperating agencies are reviewing that work as it goes along. We're agreeing on how those models and studies are going to be done, and we're also actually agreeing on timelines during that process. That's something that both the agencies and the company are working through as that time is underway. It can lead to project changes. It is not unusual for the companies as they get into working on some of those models, some of those studies of the site, to find things that were either hiccups or things that they hadn't anticipated, or they thought that the answer to the question was going to be one thing, and when the modeling actually spit the answer out, it was something different, and they have to go back and modify their approach. Those, again, lead to places where time gets added to the process, because you have to answer their question You have to have the right answer coming out through that document. Those final reports are then delivered to the consultant and the agencies, where they make sure that it's adequate, that it really answered all the questions that we wanted it to. That would leave to the draft EIS preparation. This is the document that goes out eventually to the public comment period, as you see there. That's prepared by the consultant, so the state agencies are not taking state agency staff time to develop that. That consultant is doing all of that writing and assembly. And it's then being reviewed on an ongoing basis by both the state agencies and those cooperating agencies that are involved in the process. Ultimately leads to a draft EIS being published. You can see there where that goes. Again, followed by a public meeting. That public meeting has to basically follow, I believe it's, I'll misspeak. It's 20 days, 28 days after the publishing, I believe, you have to have that public meeting. It allows the public to look at the document for a while and decide if they have questions or think about what their questions might be. Then you have that public information meeting where they get to come and ask those questions of the agencies. And then that's all during the public comment period on the draft EIS. So throughout that time period, people are able to write us cards and letters and notes and emails telling us what is wrong, right, or otherwise with the document. After that's all done, the agencies have to close out all of those public comments again and decide what are the relevant comments, what are the things that we have to address back to those folks who took the time to do that. Did they raise something that we either hadn't addressed or it just wasn't clear and we need to clarify that? That leads to a final EIS that ultimately gets published with that much shorter review period, as you can see there. The idea being that if we've all done a good job, the final EIS should really not have changed a whole lot, because it's really about just addressing whatever those gaps were that were identified by the public comment period. So then we're down to that decision point of the state adequacy determination. That's a decision not on the merits of the project, not on the permits of the project, but on, did the EIS meet the law? Did it look at all of the impacts that it was supposed to? Did it identify them correctly? And did it identify mitigations that should be required for the project to go forward? That's what an adequacy decision basically does. The federal record of decision is similar, but it follows the federal process. It's called a record of decision instead of an adequacy determination. The record of decision on the federal side oftentimes is accompanied by the permit decision as well. So if the Corps of Engineers is going to be issuing a wetlands permit on the project, they will typically issue that at the same time they issue that record of decision. For the state agencies, the final permits are actually then issued typically, actually very short time after the EIS is, the decision is made. So I'm going to go back through it just to hit some of those delays in the EIS process. The joint federal state EIS is cumbersome at times. Again, back to analogy of herding cats, you have a lot of people that are involved. The more people you have, the more difficult the process gets to manage. Project complexity is obviously a thing that can add to delays in an EIS process. Why do most of the taconite plants move through the process seemingly a little faster? Because one thing is they are a fairly well-known commodity. Most of those projects, we know how taconite mills operate. We know how those mines operate. We know the scopes of the kinds of issues that are likely to come up in that. It just goes with it that because the complexity of those are different than some of the other ones, they may move through the process more quickly. If you imagine a new sulfide mine, for instance, with no names attached, any one of them being the first in the door and having to answer all of those questions that people have that we haven't answered before, it's going to take longer because there's going to be a lot of things that people haven't anticipated. Project description is another thing that also leads to delays. This is one of those places where That description oftentimes comes in more as a it's a concept. It's not an actual project. You don't have all of the details nailed down yet. You're still a work in progress. You don't know whether you're going to hang the pipe over here or hang it over there. That's the kind of stuff that can lead to delays, because as you go through and you start doing all of this, these studies, the modeling, and you then start trying to change parameters in the middle of that, as I talked about earlier, it has ramifications back through many of the other studies that you've done. So project descriptions that come in and they really know what they're going to build and they really know how they're going to build it will move more quickly through the process than those that don't.
Excuse me, members, we're going to take about another 5 minutes to have him wrap it up here. These are a lot of issues that we're going to be talking about here in the near future, so I appreciate your indulgence here, but about another 5 minutes we can wrap it up.
Thank you. The technical studies, that's just, again, another place where as the complexity of the project increases, the more technical studies you have to have, the more places where you can insert delay or result errors and those kinds of things into the process. Conflict communication coordination, I talked on this a little bit. Again, talking across the dinner table to my family, they know what I mean when I say something. The family's bigger when you do these projects and you lose things in translation often. Adds time as you have to go back and re-explain or redefine things that you thought were off the table. Project modifications, that's again back to this thing where if you know how you're going to build it and you're not going to change it, it's going to go better. If you all of a sudden decide that you're going to use a new process halfway through it, you're going to add time because you're going to be back to square one again. Another thing that has come up more recently is the changing regulatory environment. As you all know, on the federal side, especially in air quality, particularly, the regulatory environment has become much more of a moving target. And so you start out a process, and 6 months into it, all of a sudden there's a new regulation and a new requirement. How to deal with those things within the EIS has to be sorted out. And that has to be sorted out oftentimes without the federal agencies actually knowing what the answer is themselves yet. They know they have a new rule, but they don't have any guidance around how to actually implement it. That has occurred on some of the recent projects and caused issues. Public controversy is obviously another big place. Projects that are not controversial don't have near as much difficulty moving through the process. You don't get 8,000 comment letters. You may get five, and addressing 5 to 8,000 just is a little easier. And then staffing, one of the things that always is an issue is, are you able to get enough people of the right kind on a project to make it happen? As you can see, there's a lot of activity that's been happening since 2005. A lot of the same expertise is needed on all those same projects, and there is a real pinch right now for those experts out in the public and private sector to be able to be brought onto these projects. To speed it along, Mr. Chair, the agency has been paying attention to this stuff. We have been involved in process improvement efforts. I won't go into all of the details, but I can tell you that we've changed our organizational structure. We have sector-specific people attached to the mining sector, because this is one of those places where there is a lot of complexity. But it's also a place where if you can build some capacity and those folks know how not only the industry works but how the regulations work around it, we can gain efficiency. We've seen that, and we've done those things to do that. We've increased our project management skills within the agency so that we try to minimize the crosstalk and the lack of communication. So with that, I do appreciate very much the opportunity to talk through a very simple thing and welcome all the questions that you're going to ask Jeff.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Members, I think we're going to be probably having some more questions before the end of the session for sure, and we appreciate your testimony here today. Members, tomorrow we'll be leaving for the trip to the mine at 7:45. excuse me, 7:30 from the front of the Capitol. And those people that are going to be traveling, I think Senator Saxog left to go get lunch ready. I'm not sure for tomorrow, but we'll have to check on that. But nevertheless, we'll see you tomorrow and look forward to getting up north to Hibbing and taking some public input. So it stands adjourned.
You coming too?
Yep.
Should be fun.
Stop.
We stop.
Yeah.